One thing that's interesting to me about the ISIP Texas is that it never sort of stayed static, right? It evolved, it changed. It had this incredible role during the Second World War as a rallying cry. It was at one point, the 1920s, people wanted to become the state song. One of the moments that is probably most impactful for me is Barbara Smith Conrad in the 2000 commencement singing the ISIP Texas. Understand Barbara Smith Conrad's story, that experience of being one of the first black students here and having the opportunity to be in the opera taken from her because of people in the state legislature who felt that she should not perform opposite a white man. Having her come back in 2000 and singing that song is so incredibly powerful to me. What this can mean. To quote Barbara, this is my state. I'm claiming this. I put in the work. I contributed. This is mine as well. I am a part of this community.
And those were the words of Richard J. Reddick. And Richard J. Reddick is the Associate Dean for Equity, Community Engagement, and Outreach in the College of Education. He's also Assistant Director of the Plan 2 Honors Program in the College of the Liberal Arts. He is a distinguished scholar and a fine academic. And he has a fascinating background that Kevin and I will get into a little bit as the show goes on, and we may even get into it now. But those are the words of Dr. Reddick, and I think they ring true for many of us in talking about the reclamation of a song and how a song and its fluidity and how any art is fluid. And his conclusion of this is my state, I'm claiming this. This is mine as well. That's kind of how Kevin and I feel about this and our hope for the Eyes of Texas. And of course, this was a clip from the release of the findings of the committee that Jay Hartzell charged with finding about the origins of the Eyes of Texas, what its historical context and implications are, and how it should be viewed and possibly treated going forward. And I think the charge of that committee, which was headed by Richard Reddick, Professor Reddick, was to establish a common set of facts. And that was a very nice way, Kevin, of saying the facts.
Yeah.
Because the discussion, as it initially came out, was full of a great deal of emotion and opinion and conjecture, but not a lot of concrete facts. And now that we have that common set of facts, you're still allowed to feel whatever way you wish about the song. It is America. It is Texas. But you can't have feelings supported by things that are necessarily unsupported by the facts. Or at least you can't claim certain facts that are no longer proven, or at least part of a reasonable analysis. And I think we as Longhorns owe a debt of gratitude to the committee and to the chairmanship of Dr. Reddick. And I hope that we now have a path for going forward.
I hope so too. And there's still going to be discussion, and that's what a college campus should be. And then there should be discussion from every side and open minds. And hopefully we can continue to do that. There's obviously going to be, whether it's players or students that don't want to participate, alumni, and that's fine. As you said, this is America, so you're free to do what you want to do. But yeah, I mean, some of the findings, I thought it was nice to get some clarity, especially with Robert E. Lee and the fact that the committee, they said this in their recap, that the committee found no evidence the lyrics were intended to show nostalgia for slavery and instead found facts that supported the song's message of accountability and how fluid that song has been, too, to where it's been used as a rallying cry, as the prof said, for a lot of different instances, especially as America changed and changed for the better from 1900 on.
Exactly. And I think, you know, talking about the Eyes of Texas as a piece of art is kind of funny sounding and hoity-toity, right?
Yeah.
But that's what it is.
Yeah.
That is what it is. And here's the thing about art. You and I can go and look at Michelangelo's David, and we can take different things away from it.
Mm-hmm.
We can be awed by its symmetry, its lines, by its suggestions of the Enlightenment and its historical context, of a growing sense that man's fate was in his own hands. And this statue is representative of that fact. And Michelangelo, of course, is a genius, both an artist, a sculptor, and a theorist. But what you don't get to say, and by the way, you could also say, I don't think it's very good. I don't think it's actually that great.
I think it's overrated.
I'm not that impressed. And by the way, is Weenie's kind of little.
That's what I was thinking. Must have been cold.
It was cold. But what you don't get to say is that Michelangelo lived in the 4th century BC and was Greek, and that actually the statue is a forgery.
Right.
And, you know, we have to have a common set of facts if we're even going to have a discussion. And so an opinion about art is valid, but if you're going to base that opinion and have a call for political action, it should be based on something substantive. And I think the committee did a very good job of, really, it's in the executive summary. If you guys don't want to read the whole report, I would encourage everyone to read the whole report, because it's kind of a fascinating historical document. And I learned things about the Eyes of Texas and the University of Texas I had never known. And so I would recommend you do that. But if you want to just look at the key takeaways, the Eyes of Texas remains our alma mater. That is how it's going to be. And I think it's as it should be. The history of the song reflects the history of America. And I think that's a key takeaway, because I think there's an associative aspect to the song, whether it's debut at a minstrel show, which has been proven correct, whether it was first sung on a segregated Jim Crow campus in 1903. That is a fact.
Yeah.
That is an inexorable, unescapable fact. And it is something that we have to grapple with and acknowledge and understand in our history. But by the same token, as something evolves and you look at its original intent as well, by the way, which was initially a satire, but became something sort of reverential. And as you said, a call for accountability, it never was intended as what they call at the time minstrelry, which is you, as part of the minstrel show performance, you have people in blackface and they talk in very exaggerated patois, and it's meant to demean and degrade. That is a part of the history of minstrel shows. But the fact that it was debuted somewhat solemnly in that minstrel show, initially as a satire, but quickly adopted by the students as something to rally around, its meaning has evolved. And almost 100 years later, you have a black woman, Barbara Smith Conrad, singing it at our year 2000 commencement. And as Richard Reddick said, claiming it as her own. And that's a wonderful thing about history, is despite what you may be told or the implications of what you read in the media or hear on the stupid channels when you're flipping around, we have made progress. And everyone can claim the Eyes of Texas as their own.
Yeah. You just think about, especially going through the history. You and I love history, so I would advise everyone, just if you like reading stuff like that, this is a good read, and especially if you have a tie to Texas, which you probably do if you're listening. But 1944, students marched on the Capitol singing the Eyes, and it was actually in support of embattled President Homer Rainey, and he was accused of hiring a conscientious objector, as well as an alleged gay professor, and it was further alleged that he wanted to admit African Americans to the university. When he was fired, students held a funeral parade for the death of academic freedom, and the Eyes of Texas was played. It just, you think about going through it, all the different positive things, and certainly it being debuted at a minstrel show is not positive. And I'm glad they got the facts on that straight. And you brought up just the atmosphere and the environment, not only in the country, but certainly on the campus, and just how segregated it was and how racist it was. Well, there have been a lot of good things that go with this song. And we should not deny what happened and how it was debuted, but there have been so many things since then that have a really positive feel to this song, and it is about uniting people. And really, what I didn't know, I knew a little bit, but I didn't realize all the different stories of how this was really used as a progressive song at UT.
Yeah, well, it was sung by migrant workers in the Rio Grande Valley when they marched on the Capitol. And just as the students were singing it in 1944, effectively shaming the regents and the legislature for firing a president who wanted to integrate the university and had hired a conscientious objector or hired a gay professor, it was basically saying, we're watching you.
Yeah.
And history is judging you, and it's not going to come out well for you. The eyes of Texas are upon you is about what's come before us, but it's also about what's come after us. And we're telling you, this isn't going to look good for you. Those eyes will be cast aside at what you're doing right now. And I think that's a powerful thing about the fluidity of art, the fluidity of literature, prose, rhetoric. And the song is a form of rhetoric, right? It's a type of argument. And it's both an exhortation to all of us that we can do better, but it's also telling us that we're standing on the shoulders of giants. And the people that came before us are looking to us to continue their legacy of making the University of Texas an elite institution in every sense. And I also think, and it's not surprising, that it became sort of synonymous with the state of Texas. Because there are many instances, and again, I'd encourage everyone to read the report, where it's sung sort of patriotically by soldiers going into war, particularly the Texas units. And when Texans would reunite overseas, they'd break into the Eyes of Texas to greet each other. And there's an example of the Isle of Tarawa. And if you know anything about World War II, it was a savage battle in the Pacific, absolutely ruthless. And a Marine, a young Texan Marine, is wounded, grievously wounded, and he's basically giving up. He can't get up. He can't walk. And a New Yorker Marine comes across him, and he knows the guy, and he's not big enough to move him because, of course, he's a Texan. He's 200 pounds, right, back then, which is a giant. And he just knows the first line to the Eyes of Texas are upon you. And he keeps whispering it and yelling it at the guy, basically trying to shame him into summoning the strength to get up and continue the fight, or at least get back to where aid can be rendered. And it works. The young Texan Marine is shamed and gets up, stumbles back, and makes it back to the medic.
That's crazy.
Little stories like that are just so amazing. And that is a use of the song just as much as its negative uses. And, you know, one thing that really struck me that I thought the committee did a fine job of bringing out was the fluidity of art, and also how common tunes are rebranded and recast. Because if you do read the original I've Been Working on the Railroad, that's a racist song.
Yeah, there's no question it is.
There's no question. Now, that song came from another song that was created in the mid-19th century. And basically, you're just borrowing and stealing these familiar tunes and then changing the lyrics. Well, the Eyes of Texas are upon you. The lyrics are not racist. They are pretty straightforward exhortation of doing your best and accountability, as they said in the report. But that's a key thing, because I think if the original lyrics had been written in what they call at the time, quote unquote, Negro dialogue, had that been the case, then I can see the reason for dismissing the song out of hand. But it wasn't. And it was not done so for a reason. Because Sinclair, the original author of this song, didn't just intend this, I think, initially as a sort of ode and / satire to the school president. But also he thought it might be something that could endure. And I think that's what happened. And of course, as it endures, its meaning changes as it creates a broader inclusiveness that really covers us all. And I'm just fascinated by the history of the song and how it's changed and transformed. And I also love the fact that they, at the end of the key takeaways, after facts and historical context matter, which could be the name of this podcast, he says, living out its meaning. And I'll quote the report. From its inception, The Eyes of Texas has always been a song about accountability. Therefore, the spirit and intention of the song compels the university to be transparent about its past and be ever more accountable to the state and its diverse people. In this sense, the work of the committee was a microcosm of what the university should stand for. Research, getting to the facts, seeking to understand others' viewpoints, continuing to learn, courageously confronting and acknowledging our history, and finding ways to strengthen our community going forward.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, it's pretty simple, and it's pretty straight to the point. I'm glad to see there was sampling going on back then. That's just not the our era of
yeah, that's an ode to Public Enemy and all the awesome rap we grew up on. Sampling, it turns out, wasn't art after all. They weren't just stealing.
So to me, the biggest thing was, what were the connection? Because I knew I've been working on the railroad was racist. And so anytime Rod and I've talked about that, it's like, well, yeah, that is. But what is this song? And really, where did the lyrics, what was their inspiration? And so the Robert E. Lee connection, that was big for me. And research failed to discover that any records of Lee ever closing an address to students at Washington College, is called now, it was Washington and Lee, with the phrase attributed to him by the account, that the connection was thought that, okay, that when this thing was written, that, or even one of the students when they were doing that at a minstrel show, that it was connected kind of to Robert E. Lee. And the fact is, they just couldn't find anything to that. Now, we've had a lot of people that have texted the show, and I've talked to people. I mean, this does seem to be one of those things that feels like people already had their mind made up. So the timing of this and the way Texas let it kind of spiral out of control in the fall, it not only, you know, cost Tom Herman possibly his job, but also it didn't help out with trying to really get the facts out and get them out early. But the facts are out now, and I do suggest that people read it. And the fact that they couldn't find any connection to Robert E. Lee, that should appease some people, right?
Well, I don't know. You know, I can't speak for some people, right? We live in a world where I'm seeing statues of abolitionists being toppled.
Yeah.
And Abraham Lincoln. They renamed Lincoln High in San Francisco because Lincoln was racist.
Yeah.
The guy who freed the slaves.
Yeah.
And Frederick Douglass, who is, if you don't know much about him, I encourage all of you to read about him. He is a giant of American history, an incredibly brave man, an escaped slave who basically self-educated and had a wonderful intellect and was a passionate speaker and rallier for abolition in the North. He is, in some circles, being cast as an Uncle Tom,
right?
Because he wanted integration and to end segregation and basically for everyone to live as one. And so that's, you know, those folks, I don't know that there's any reasonable report or any reasonable dialogue that can change their mind. My hope is that it will. But I think what this report was intended for was the middle. Reasonable people who were curious to see what the true origins and intents of the song were. And I hope that those people will be satisfied that this research was done painstakingly and it was done based on empirical fact-based review and it was thorough. And, you know, these connections to Robert E. Lee, I think, so the fear is not just necessarily that someone who was a Confederate once uttered something.
Right.
Right. I think the greater fear is that the song was a hidden nostalgia for the old South and slavery.
Yes.
And we're watching you, right? This is about surveilling you. And
which is why they,
you know, just,
which is why I read that earlier. The committee made sure to say there was no evidence intended to show nostalgia for slavery.
Exactly correct. I'm so glad you read that from the committee report.
I mean, and that may have been the biggest thing I took out of all 58 pages.
Yes. And by the way, the eyes of blank are upon you, as pointed out in the committee report. And this is something I knew and you and I had talked about months ago. That is a common rhetorical refrain. And you could find it in the Bible. You can find it in George Washington's address to his troops. You can find it in Martin Luther King speeches, right? The eyes of a nation are upon you. You can find it, and this was not mentioned in the committee report, but I knew it off the top of my head just because I'm a history guy. Dwight D. Eisenhower wrote a letter to all the troops on the eve of Normandy, and it was read aloud to all the paratroopers who were standing on the tarmacs in England about to get flung out of an airplane in the middle of anti-aircraft fire in 1944 technology with a piece of tarp over their heads, hoping that would open. And it says, the eyes of the world are upon you. You cannot fail. And, you know, it's something that you see throughout history. It's a very common rhetorical device. And so for people to think that the eyes of Texas are upon you was this unique thing. It wasn't. And it also gets back to the borrowing and the sampling that we talked about. Think about context, and I'll present it to you in this way. Our national anthem is derived from a British drinking song.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's hilarious. And I've read the lyrics to that song. It's unlistenable, but it's actually kind of a ribald drinking song. It's kind of like saucy, you know, it's all about getting drunk and picking up women. And that's our national anthem. So does anyone think that when we are bringing back a soldier or an airman or a Marine who died fighting for this country, and they put him in a coffin and lay him or her to rest, and they play the national anthem solemnly, do you think that's intended as a mockery or a satire of is it a drinking song right then?
No.
Or has it transformed in its meaning and context and use?
It's evolved, like most things in life.
It's evolved. And that's the beauty of the Eyes of Texas, is I hope that people can accept its evolution. The other thing I want to bring out about Professor Reddick, and he's an interesting, really interesting guy. He's an Austin boy, just like you and me, Kevin.
Really? What school?
He's a graduate of Johnston High.
Good for him.
He has a master's and a PhD from Harvard. He's a pretty acclaimed academic. His undergraduate degree is the University of Texas.
Yeah, I knew that.
He's a graduate of the Plan 2 Honors Program. And I can tell you, I don't know Professor Reddick personally, but I do know people who do know him, and I've read some of his writings, and I've been honored to read some of his musings about the world and what's going on. And he is a product of Johnston High. Don't ever forget that. And for those of you who don't know, Austin Johnston High is a high school, or was a high school, on the east side of Austin. And it had existed before, but it really came to the fore in the late 1970s through the early to mid 1990s, because it was effectively a social experiment. It was a product of busing. And I know that because my older sister and my older brother are both graduates of Johnston High School. And so what they did, Kevin, is they took a bunch of kids from South Austin. And this is back when South Austin was what? Bubba Land, right?
Yeah.
Austin, for those of you who don't know, had a much more culturally pronounced difference once you crossed the river 30, 40 years ago, right? That's since faded, but the joke was South Austin was your rednecks and your hicks, and it was Bubba Land and, you know, the blue collar folks and the people living north of the river. Those were your white collar yuppies and, you know, soft. And you know, every year they used to have a big, do you remember the big tug of war across Town Lake?
Oh, yes, 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 I do.
So they used to have all the people from North Austin and South Austin would each get on the side of Town Lake and do a tug of war.
And, I mean,
that's how much there was a cultural rivalry within the city. So Johnston High School was comprised of bust kids from South Austin, bust kids from Northwest Hills, where I grew up, where my sister and my brother grew up, from East Austin, the predominantly black or African-American part of East Austin, and then the Mexican part of East Austin, for lack of a better term, right? I'm supposed to say Latinx or whatever you're supposed to say now.
Actually, you shouldn't, because Latinos don't like that at all. And,
no, exactly.
And studies have shown that.
It's only white people with cultural studies degrees in San Francisco who think that, whereas all my Mexican friends are like, dude, I'm Mexican.
Right. No, every Mexican I've talked to is like, don't ever say that.
Yeah. Well, so And I know the Mexicans you talk to, specifically the female kind.
Well, hey, I didn't give a gender. They're still Mexican.
Oh, absolutely. But we're digressing. Austin Johnson was this social experiment of busing of all these different groups effectively coming together in East Austin in this high school.
It was a true melting pot, wasn't it?
It was a true melting pot, and if you talk to any graduate of Johnston from that time period, what's amazing is how well everyone got along, the level of school pride they had, the fun that they had. It was kind of a wild school, and the sort of feeling that they all have for old Johnston. Now, Johnston ended up becoming Eastside High, and effectively it died, but there are all these old Austin Johnston graduates out there who have this fondness for the school and kind of what it was. And it's not surprising to me that Richard Reddick was a product of that school.
Great stuff there.
Because that is what he has taken forward. I think he's seen the possibilities of what can be. And while he is someone that is deeply involved in African-American history, and the history of slavery and the diaspora and how the socio-cultural effects and changes within that group, he doesn't read that history as its own isolated silo, right?
Yeah.
He views it as American history.
Yeah.
He views that as Texan history.
And there's more depth to it as well.
And there's more depth to it because the minute you silo yourself in academia, the minute you become a special interest, the minute you lose that connectivity to the tissue of the rest of history, you lose something. And what you lose is context. And Dr. Reddick, if you scratch him, he bleeds burnt orange because he believes that the state university representing us all represents a higher calling. And you will not meet a human being who loves the University of Texas more than Dr. Reddick, warts and all. And one thing that he has said before, and I believe he may have even included it in the report, there used to be an old expression in the Texas Revolutionary War and going forward, and it was kind of a rhetorical flourish that Texans would always say, and it was, "For Texas, I will." And it was the idea of whatever Texas needed, I'll do it. And he always said, it was not "for Texas, I will" when things get better. What he said is, it needs to be "for Texas, I will" for all of us. And you are going to be the instrument that gets things better. You're not going to wait for things to be better and then you'll throw your lot in and say, okay, now I'll sing the school song now, or I'll do this now, or I'll volunteer for this hard duty now, because X, Y, and Z demands of mine have been met. He said, no. You need to be in the fight. And then by doing that, you'll earn the value and the respect of others. They'll see you for your humanity and your dedication. And now they're open to your demands. And now they're open to your change. And that is the history of integration at the University of Texas. You know, these men and women who are so brave to come onto that campus, who walk into class would be told in no uncertain terms, you're not welcome here. Now, there are other students saying quietly, I'm glad you're here.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not, I would say, a majority. And there was a lot of hostility and they weathered that storm. And they didn't say, some of these were very fine students. They could have gone up north. We always talk about the Underground Railroad with, you know, Texas, because of its segregated history, lost all these incredible football players in the 1950s and 60s to northern universities because they didn't want – well, first of all, they couldn't play at Texas, and right. They didn't want to play at Texas. Bubba Smith – and by the way, a lot
it
of
started,
guys,
it started with they couldn't, and then, man, that – you know, that stigma, even the 80s, when you look at how bad Texas was, a lot of that was black families didn't trust Texas. I mean, Jerome Sapp, nope. you remember Jerome Sapp, the number one safety in the country, played at Houston Lamar in the same defensive backfield as Rod Babers?
Sure do.
Rod told me, you know, Jerome Sapp ended up going to Notre Dame. Jerome Sapp came from a great family, and not just because he went to Notre Dame, but Jerome Sapp could have gone anywhere, not only athletically, but also academically, and he'd probably be the type of kid now that would go to Stanford. And he, you know, Rod was going to Texas, but his mom wouldn't let him go. It's like, Texas is a racist school. And that was still the thought in 1998 or 9.
Yeah, that was why people like James Brown as quarterback at Texas, or of course Vince Young, as T.J. Ford even, aside from making Texas cool, it broke a lot of walls and barriers and perceptions that were deeply embedded in the culture of a lot of black communities. And you know, there was a sense that you were a sellout, right? If you were going to Texas, mm-hmm. because they were late to the party. You know, it wasn't much better than going to Ole Miss, frankly, in their mind. And that was shattered, thank God. And I hope this report will serve a similar role in how this song, which is, you know, who cares at one level, it's a song, right?
Yeah.
But at another level, this is a song that's been sung for some pretty crucial moments in Texas and American history. And it's been a rallying cry and a common point. And I think to get back to Dr. Reddick and his exhortation about the song is that for Texas, I will. And let's see if we can come together with some common understanding that for those of us, it's a coalition of the willing. For those of us who do want to all stand together and have some of these common values and decide what Texas is and what it represents, then let's do that. And those who want to exclude themselves, you know, it's your right to do so. But you can no longer exclude yourself pretending that you're supported by all the facts.
Yeah. I think it's important, too, with someone like Dr. Reddick, who, like all of us should, cares about this deeply and cares about equality, not equity, equality, and really making America as fair of a place as humanly possible. Because of the national perspective, and you kind of touched on a little bit with Abe Lincoln and some of the abolitionists that are getting canceled, I think that really muddies the water. And for people like that, that it is kind of their life mission and what they do, the ones that I really take seriously are the ones that understand and take the real stuff seriously and will also call out some of the stuff or just present facts and say, no, it's easy just to jump on board and say everything should be canceled, but there are some things that really still need probably to be looked at, including some of the buildings at UT, which they've already made that move. And what it also does is, for the people that don't think anything is racist, it allows them to have a huge sample of evidence that says, you know what, this is bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for someone like Dr. Reddick, I think for stuff like this, I expected him to take it very seriously. I don't question whether he's got the backs of any people or any race on that campus, and certainly not African Americans. But for him to come out and say, no, I, you know, from what we saw and from what the committee saw, this was not intended to be a racist song. It just proves to me, and not just this, but just other stuff I've seen with him, how serious he should be taken by every single side whenever he talks about racial matters.
Yeah, and I think Dr. Reddick and you and I talk this way and we're thinking this way, and I wonder to what extent, even though we are cynical and don't put a lot of faith in the news media and the sorts of things and spins they put on things, even us using a term like side, which is understandable, I think Dr. Reddick would say there's not really a side.
Right. Oh, no, I wish there wasn't, but I'm going to call it for what it is. And unfortunately,
yeah, I hear you.
This thing has been split into two sides.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. And
it's binary. Neither one wants you in the middle.
Yeah, well, and I just think that there's a sense that you're with us or you're against us.
Yep.
And it's like, hey, let's actually take us where the facts take us. And if you do a deep and intensive review of this and you find what you find, well, let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah.
And that's good scholarship. That is exactly holding the high standards that the Eyes of Texas exhorts us to uphold.
Right, and that includes, if this would have come back, that this did have racist intent when the song was written. Got to get rid of it.
Yeah, I mean, look, if the original lyrics had been written in dialect, if the original performances for the first several years had all been done exclusively in blackface and minstrel shows and as a form of denigration, and if you'd found secret notes and archives saying this is our secret under the radar way of keeping the promise of the South and Confederacy and slavery alive, and the song is actually a warning that, you know, that Jim Crow must persist. Hey, we're done. We're done here. we're moving on. I mean, I'm taking Notre Dame's fight song and recasting it with like cooler lyrics.
Impossible.
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 Kevin's about to hang up on.
Oh,
well,
man. You know,
Kevin,
what, though?
Hopefully
what we're doing is what Texas fans can do, and that's have discussion about it. And you and I on this agree more than disagree, but there are going to be a lot of people, family members, friends. I think we got to remember that we can't let this, we can't turn this into the three stations you were talking about earlier. And as a Texas family and as a Longhorn family, got to have some respect, be adults when discussing this, and it's okay to disagree.
It is. And I think what Kevin is calling for is a big house.
Yes.
We want a big house. We don't want a bunch of little condominiums where you don't talk to your neighbors. We want one big house. And if you're looking for a big house, or you want to refi your existing big house, whether it's Longhorn or otherwise, you need to give Gabe Winslow and his outstanding mortgage team a call, 832-557-1095. Gabe is phenomenal at what he does. If you mention me or Kevin, or if you mention the words Eyes of Texas,
ooh,
Gabe is going to give you $500 off of your closing, no questions asked. Hey, here's the deal right now with mortgage rates. You may have noticed that they're in flux. They've been rising. Actually, they've been very volatile. And what Gabe recommends is that you get in your application as soon as possible and then effectively empower him to have a limit order. Try to find a number that you want to hit and then let Gabe execute it within a day or within the actual trading of the day of mortgage and equities. And if you trust a guy and he's sharp enough, he can make an incredible deal for you. I'm telling you, Gabe Winslow is that mortgage broker. So if you want to take some money out of your house or you're getting a new house, give Gabe a call, 832-557-1095, and he is going to take care of you.
Gabe doing some good work. Man, this is a weird, weird market to be in, but if anyone's going to take care of you, it will definitely be Gabe. So, yeah, so it's been interesting. I mean, the text line yesterday and trying to keep that family as big as possible, and I think it's easy because it's just, it wasn't like this back in the day. People used to disagree on politics, and it didn't turn into like canceling family members and friends and all that. And trust me, that happens. Here you go, Paul, on both sides. And I think the biggest thing is moving forward, what happens when things come up. So the one thing that I had no tolerance for throughout all this stuff, I mean, there are people that didn't want to, you know, get rid of the song and let them speak their mind. And I may disagree, but we can do that. And then people that really wanted to keep it. Yeah, I wanted to keep it. So it's an easy sell on my part. But some people made some good points on both sides. But the people that definitely wanted to keep it, that players came out and said they were threatened that they would not be able to get a job in the state of Texas. To me, that shit's way too far. I've got no tolerance for that. That's where we got to be able to agree to disagree and not threaten people like that.
Yeah, it's a form of cancel culture.
Yeah, it's exactly what it is.
I don't like it. Here's the problem with that. That was exaggerated.
Okay.
So the University of Texas alumni is, what, almost 500,000 living people?
550,000.
There you go. So more than 500,000. In 500,000 people, you're going to get a range of personalities.
Yeah.
you're going to have a few convicted murderers, Kevin.
Yeah,
right?
Right.
So
imagine where Florida is with their grads.
Exactly right. So to selectively take certain emails that were revealed by the Freedom of Information request to Hartzell, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or to take a random idiot on Twitter sending Caden Stearns a tweet when there's, by the way, 24 tweets of support right underneath it. To take that and to generalize that into prominent UT alumni. Well, first of all, the word prominent was thrown in there. None of these are from like movers and shakers in the world of Texas. These are just random alums.
Yeah.
And some of them may not even be alums.
Right. So if it's on Twitter, you have no idea.
Exactly. And so I think that was misconstrued. So yes, while on one hand, yes, I find that to be silly. I don't like that. On the other hand, to hold that up as if there was a cabal of wealthy, prominent alums threatening the players, do this or else, which was the insinuation of several of these articles, it's nonsensical. And I applaud Jay Hartzell's response, which basically says, I don't care what random email, and I'm summating here, I don't care what random email I get from an idiot. I don't even pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
I have launched a committee to get to the truth of this and to create a common understanding and a common set of facts. That report's coming soon. Let's all be edified by it. And all the rest of it's news, noise disguised as news. And I got to say, the immediate reaction to this report being released, I've seen some sober, factual assessments of the report, which is to the credit of some of the media. I've seen several personalities, the predictable ones, who say, effectively, the University of Texas will continue to make people sing its racist song.
Yeah.
And it's very clear they didn't read the report. Or if they did so selectively and chose to do so in an almost propagandistic fashion. And they could be factual, but it's in such a decontextualized manner that it's actually deceptive. And I'll give you an example. There's an old famous joke of there is a competition in the 1970s that was held by a neutral international body between the best Soviet-produced car, the Volga, which is a vulgar representation of a car. It was horrible. And I think, you know, a good old American Ford. I don't know what it was. And body did the comparison. It was only two cars. And, of course, the Ford wins in everything, right? Comfort, styling, engineering, blah, blah, blah. The propagandic headline that comes out from TASS, which is the Soviet news service, says, in international car competition, U.S. finishes second to last. Soviet Union finishes second. Now, is that factually true?
Factually, it is, yeah.
That is a factually correct series of statements. Are they misleading or decontextualized?
Yes.
Yes. And so I think when you have a report of this substance and quality and seriousness and frankly sensitivity is released, and your initial reaction as a journalist is to hunt through it and find the gotcha moments of, oh, confirmed, this was launched at a minstrel show, thus it's racist. I mean, no attempt to contextualize, no attempt to understand the greater, broader meaning of the entire report. And they're just going to throw out these headline-grabbing sorts of propaganda. There's nothing else you can call it. And I have a real, real problem with that, as much as a problem with the random idiots who are threatening players for exercising their right to speech.
Yeah, I'm with you, man. And we seem to see the lack of contextualizing stuff more and more from the media. And I've seen it most of my career, but it's just gotten worse and worse and actually more flagrant now. They used to be better at trying to hide it or be clever about it.
Well, and I think there was a sense of almost a shared professional standard of we share these assumptions, but you can't be this grotesque.
That's exactly what it was. And I almost heard that verbatim off mics.
Yes. I mean, that is exactly how I feel, because there was almost a sense of like, hey, man, like, we're all on the same team here, but that's ridiculous. Come on, man. You're making us look stupid.
Yeah. We have to have some credibility.
And I don't think those conversations are happening anymore.
No, I don't think so. Hopefully they can get back to it. Getting back to just the report, a couple things that we have not hit that we probably should. Or here's one that Dr. Reddick said, there's no absolution, nor is there vindication. This is a complicated story. You can't really parse out this. This is clean and clear. We do know and feel comfortable saying the intent was to parody Prather. And I think we hit that. Definitely hit that last time we talked about it. We can get back into that. But to me, that was another big takeaway that they're not trying to be absolute about anything. Here are the facts, and you're allowed to make up your own mind. But as I said earlier, the biggest thing I took was the song was not overtly racist.
Yeah, well, and also I thought there was a clever thing that he said in the letter to Hartzell that begins the examination, and he says, I don't want this report to be used as a cudgel.
Yeah, yeah.
And for those of you who aren't used to fancy words, a cudgel is like a club. And for you, Kevin, a shillelagh.
Now, you know what? That's overtly racist. That's overtly racist.
Or if you're drunk and you turn your whiskey bottle over when it's empty and you swing it at a cop. Just trying to name Irish things, Kevin.
God, I know. I thought we were going to get into bad food and too many potatoes after that.
I forgot to mention in this big house.
What about
that
a heavy
I want,
breakfast?
In this big house that I want Kevin in the back. He's Cato Kalin. He's going to live out in the pool house.
Guess what? I want you in the basement.
I know. Well, that's where all bloggers are, right? We're all in our mom's basement.
Yeah, you're right, exactly. I want you chained up, and I'll get you a big bowl of water and feed you some dog food occasionally.
Exactly. Well, hey, we did talk about the big orange house, and if you are shopping for a literal orange house in Austin, Texas, or Centex, or if you want to list your house, we have got the person for you. Her name is Laura Baker. She is a fantastic realtor. She is sharp, and she is on the ball. She sent me a great story to present, and I think it's worth mentioning. If you're an investor, right now is a good time to look at liquidating your assets in Austin. And I think this is also generalizable, even if you're just a regular person that owns a home or wants to list your home. There's no inventory in Austin right now, Kevin.
Yep.
I don't know if that's something that's news to you. I don't think it is.
No.
And a home that would typically sit for months, it's selling instantly. And if you are an investor or just a regular homeowner and you want to highlight your home, you need to enlist a real estate agent who will work for you. Here's an example of what my sister, Laura Baker, did for one of her clients. They had a bunch of inventory in Pflugerville, a bunch of homes. She actually hired on the crew to make the improvements. The investor didn't have to worry about any of it. And so she contracted with the crew. She oversaw it. She did a bunch of cosmetic changes that would increase and maximize the value of the homes. She priced the properties properly. She staggered them in the inventory so they didn't all come out at once and compete against each other. And she really manipulated, frankly, buyer psychology. And that is what you have to have. If you want to hire a real estate agent and you think that their job is only showing you a few houses and saying, what do you want to buy? That's not the real estate agent that you can maximize with. The real estate agent that you will maximize with is a partner. And they're going to partner with you not only in highlighting your home and making the changes needed cosmetically to put its best foot forward and inflate its value, but also to engage in the bidding process and the psychological process of a deal at a sophisticated level. And most real estate agents, frankly, are not very good at that. So I want you to give Laura a call if you're in the Centex area. Highly recommended, 512-784-0505. Once again, that's Laura Baker. She is a part of the Andy Allen team at Keller Williams. 512-784-0505.
I think that's good advice. There's some money to be made right now. Multiple bids.
Oh, my God.
Multiple offers. It can be a teardown, and you're getting something for it. So you just want to make sure you really do want to make sure you have the right person. And I even talked to some people that are familiar with her that are in the industry, and they don't know her, but thumbs up is what they've heard and what they've seen. So they were like, yeah, that's a good get for y'all. And I was like, well, it's Paul's sister. Otherwise, we don't get her.
Well, you know what? It's funny. I still own a home in Southwest Austin, and I jumped on Redfin and Zillow just to see what their estimate was if I sold it. And I thought it was a misprint.
Yeah. A lot of people do when they're doing that.
I mean, how nuts is that? It's just a crazy market. And I tell you, folks, if you are either a seller or a buyer, now more than ever, you need a good real estate agent. You need a good mortgage guy. And frankly, you need some larger, broad financial advice.
Yes, you
that
do.
Will carry you forth, because we're trying to put together the whole recipe for our audience. And I think we've got one vital part of the audience recipe that we've left out.
Yeah, no, we've got the real estate stuff covered. But once you make some money off of that, you got to make sure you do something with it and really, really take advantage of whatever situation you're in. And that's where David McClellan comes into play. Fiduciary financial advisor from Forum Financial. This guy really is sharp and knows what he is doing. He's seen the industry from every angle. And so he's been a financial advisor. He's got plenty of experience doing that. But for me, that's always big. And that can be big in any industry, especially this one. So he does specialize in financial life coaching, also retirement planning. And he's offering free consultations to our listeners. So that's something you should take advantage of. Just mention the podcast, and he's going to help you understand kind of where you're at, but more importantly, your financial freedom number. And that's exactly what it is. Maybe some things you could be doing differently to build your wealth and also get to that number a little bit faster. David will help you out. He'll do it for that free consultation. 312-933-8823. 312-933-8823. Or you can email him, dmcclellan@forumfin.com.
Well, Kevin, before we close, and we will be closing with some closing remarks from the video which the University of Texas released, which summarized its findings. It's a 17-minute video. I'd encourage everyone to go listen to it if you have not had the time to read the report. Before I tell you about the folks that we're going to be closing this podcast episode with, is there anything further that we should touch upon in discussing this?
I mean, I'm trying to think, and not really. I'll just say I really respect what the committee did and the fact that they put it together. And I understand that there are some people, I mean, this is one of those that people that wanted this song to go away felt like, well, the conclusion was already made up before the committee came together. And that's a fair criticism, because that may be the case. I'm not sure that totally takes away, though, from the facts that they ended up finding.
Yeah, I think that's a fair summation. So I would say people of character and intellect should look at the facts.
Yeah.
And wrestle and grasp at those facts and try to make sense of them and try to, where those facts may contradict your inherent or innate bias, I would say you need to look at not contorting those facts so that you can maintain your current viewpoint unvarnished mm-hmm. and untarnished, but rather you should look at trying to wrap your viewpoint around those facts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that can apply to everyone, because I think there's a famous quote by a woman named Hannah Arendt, and she said, every 20 to 30 years, civilization is invaded by barbarians. They're called children. And what she meant, of course, by that is, if we fail to educate, if we allow sloppy narratives and, frankly, irresponsible media-driven narratives to dictate our knowledge and our understanding of the world, we have failed, in a sense, in our charge to educate the children, to educate the next generation. And by the way, that education goes both ways, because we also need to understand what the University of Texas was in 1903 and what it wasn't. And some of those aspects of what it was are kind of shameful.
Not kind of, they are shameful.
Yeah, and some of the aspects of what it wasn't are also important.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're going to all have a common history, we need to start accepting that things can change and evolve. Because if we can't, and I don't mean to be dramatic here, but if you want to start history anew and pretend nothing before us has ever been good enough or pure enough because it touched upon things that were evil, you're talking about year one, year zero.
Yeah.
You're talking about the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia.
Yeah.
You're talking about Pol Pot saying history never existed and we're starting over. And you're talking about a third of your population being slaughtered.
Yep.
That's year zero. That's when you devoid yourself of any knowledge or understanding of a common history or a common humanity or a common acceptance of different types of people.
It's well said. Erasing history is never a good thing. And one thing that Rod said that I took to heart was he said, as a black guy, if I looked at everything and wanted to find any little thing that may have been connected to it or tethered to it, we would tear down this whole country. And he was like, we can't rebuild that. We've got to pick and choose stuff that is real and that is flagrant and still go after it. But on stuff like this, there's just going to be gray area on stuff. And that's life.
That is life. Well, to help negotiate that gray area, there are a couple of people that we're going to close this podcast with, some video clips. One of them, or audio clips in your case. One of them is Clotilde Davis-Haynes. This is a woman who is the head of the Precursors. The Precursors are a group of former students who were the early integrators at the University of Texas.
Wow. Talk about courageous.
Talk about courageous. And she is going to have some interesting thoughts. And then it's going to transition to a combination of Dr. Reddick and some of his closing thoughts, and also the thoughts of Henry Brands, who is a fine history professor at the University of Texas. And both of them are going to talk about what the Eyes of Texas really is and should represent, we hope, to the largest group of people. So with that, we end this episode. Next week, we'll be talking about sports. But this week, we thought we should talk about this and, frankly, lay some of this to rest.
Totally agree. All right, let's say goodbye, and we'll say goodbye. We usually just say goodbye and we're out. We've got a nice little capper here, Paul.
Absolutely. You guys take care.
I didn't sing the song when I was a student, but I came here in 1968, a time of protests for civil rights. I came to the school because I received a scholarship, but I felt not necessarily connected in every way to the school. So if the facts revealed that the history of that song was racist, I have to say that it would not have surprised me. The surprise for me is that it wasn't.
It's pretty clear from the evidence the Eyes of Texas Are Upon You is exhorting people to do their absolute best because you are being scrutinized. You do not have the benefit of being at a university that has a long tradition. Students were referred to as barbarians, and the faculty were looked down upon.
The Eyes of Texas Are Upon You because Texas, for the students, Texas is subsidizing your education. Texas is looking to you for great things.